Welcome to The Roofer Show with your host, Dave Sullivan. You found the podcast that helps roofing contractors grow their businesses, make more money, and have more free time. Each week, Dave interviews the industry's top experts who will give you actionable tips and strategies for the real world of construction to help you take your roofing business to the next level. So let's get down to business.
Hey everybody, what's up? Welcome to The Roofer Show, the place to be if you want to grow a more profitable roofing business. I'm your host, Dave Sullivan, the Roofer Coach, and I help small to medium-sized businesses get their business organized. Simple, easy, basics, nothing really complicated, but if you need some help just getting organized, getting things straightened out, putting a business plan together, let me know, and that's something I can help you with. Today, we've got a great show. I wanted to do a follow-up of our episode number 376 from the other day, and that was 1099 versus W-2 employees. Whole thing is starting up. We've had a lot of interest on our YouTube channel replaying this. I mean, we've got a lot of downloads, a lot of people interested in this. There's been a number of changes in the last week I've been reading about in the trades, and I wanted to get Philip Siegel back on here and follow up on this because we had a great discussion the other day. But first, I just want to take a minute to thank our sponsor, and that is SMA Support. These guys are great. They provide a fantastic service that so many contractors need. We're talking about giving you an inside salesperson to prep estimates, follow up with customers, and even help manage your schedule, all without the headache of hiring and training. Or fill in the operations gap to ensure that jobs are scheduled and permits are pulled, and walk your customer through that five-star experience and even get that five-star review. SMA Support handles all the behind-the-scenes work so you can focus on what you do best. Imagine your roofing business with no more dropped balls and don't have tasks falling through the cracks. So check out SMA Support at smasupport.us. And tell them Dave sent you. Okay, well, let's get into it. So Philip Siegel, our expert labor attorney that we've worked with for 20 years. What is going on, Philip? How are you?
I'm doing well, but it was a whirlwind of a week last week for labor and employment attorneys around the country. Kind of a double whammy between the FTC coming out of its meeting and striking down non-competes, and then the Department of Labor issuing its new rule on overtime, the salary level test. So busy week for me. Heard from a lot of friends from around the country, not slowing down.
All right. Well, just for our listeners that did not check out 376, which you should, because you'll get the full story there, give us just an overview of what we discussed, because this 1099 versus W-2 thing is huge right now. So just real quick, give us a summary.
Sure.
Update us on what's happening. I did see where there's a huge fine from a contractor. This stuff is actually happening, as from what I can tell. So,
yeah, well, Dave, thanks. The overtime and the FTC we'll get to, that's just last week. The independent contractor, the misclassification issue, that has been out effective as of mid-March. And most recently, or to summarize what happened in mid-March is, two things happened with one, really one action. And that one action was to both publish a new rule under the Biden administration, which had the effect of withdrawing what was the Trump rule on this misclassification issue. I think a good way to explain it from a high level is to explain that the Trump rule on misclassification set the bar very low for employers to successfully argue their workers were correctly classified as independent contractors. And the Trump rule did that by focusing on two core factors. One, the level of control exhibited by the employer. And number two, the individual worker's ability to earn a profit or potentially suffer a loss depending on their efficiency. Those two factors kind of carried the day. And when you dive into the analysis that follows under those two factors, well, that's why I say the bar was low. to properly classify someone as an independent contractor. What happened with the Trump, what happened with the Biden rule was they took the Trump rule off the table and they reintroduced what is a totality of the circumstances analysis that looks through a variety of factors. They do still look at the control, the opportunity for profit or loss, but those are just being thrown into the wash with the other various factors. And by including what are six factors under the Biden rule and minimizing the importance of what were the core factors under the Trump rule, the bar has been significantly raised. So while it may be easily to clear, and based on the level of control, the worker's ability to make a profit, these are independent contractors. But when you throw in the other four factors, to get in the win column on those four factors, it's a significantly higher burden, higher hurdle to clear. And consequently, employers are going to have a more difficult time arguing that a worker is properly classified as an independent contractor. And you're seeing that. I mean, the rule's been in effect now, and now you've got the Department of Labor out there conducting wage and hour audits, focusing on this issue. I mentioned in our last session, Dave, that you began with, I'm also seeing it in the context of OSHA investigations. But the Department of Labor just recently published, they've caught the first construction company here. I'm looking at it, $1.2 million in back wages and penalties that were assessed. Now, a company that's making the press like that, those are some pretty egregious violations there, including potentially falsifying documentation to indicate overtime was being paid when it wasn't. So, those are egregious cases, but make no mistake, as I think some of your audience and listeners are going to soon be experiencing, if they have not already, this issue is back under the microscope and in the hot seat.
The contractors that I'm hearing from, we're talking about two things for the most part, which is your installation crews that may be subcontractors, and then more importantly, are your salespeople. For the most part, what I'm hearing is most companies use maybe one or two installation crews. The crews do work for other contractors. And I think a lot of times they meet that, but obviously everybody needs to check that out pretty clearly. But when it comes to the salespeople, most everybody I know is 1099'd. And that, according to these rules and the bar, there's no way. These guys are W-2 employees. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, when they're only working for the one company and that's problematic right there. When we focus on what the six factors are, and I refer back to the last session we had, really, is that person in business for themselves? What investment are they making to increase their compensation? But if they're only selling for one company, it's unlikely that you're going to prevail to argue that person successfully or is correctly identified as an independent contractor. Where does that leave you? I touched on it in the last episode. Well, if you're misclassifying them as independent contractors, the law says they're employees. They belong on your payroll. We talked a little bit last session on how you can avoid paying overtime by fitting, if they do fit within the outside sales exemption. I know some companies are hesitant to bring people on. The salespeople on because they're worried about unemployment or workers' comp premiums. Well, the workers' comp premium, that's going to be a state-specific law on whether you're obligated to provide workers' comp. But those are going to be if you're misclassifying, then the law says they're employees. These are good. Those are the consequences. You're either. And I mean, if you're doing it wrong, you're doing it wrong. And there's no advice I can give that makes it right. And I'm talking specifically about the individual companies that are working with and the salespeople are only working for the one employer. And by all appearances are employed by that one employer. And those are tough, tough, tough cases.
Most everybody is doing that with their salespeople, 1099s.
Yeah, I get the better case, I feel, and I've had this experience too, the sales guy who's selling for different companies and is carrying around different business cards indicating, right. You know, by the way, those business cards present the individual as an employee of the company. That is not going to help your case. But stepping back a little bit, the salesman is carrying five business cards because they're selling for five different companies. And now it begins to look a little bit more like they're in the business, they're in business for themselves. I would question, you know, focusing on one of the key factors there is what investment is that person making in their business to grow it? You know, what are they doing to get more companies to sell for? It's tough with the sales folks that are, again, I'm repeating myself, just if you have a salesperson and that salesperson is only selling for you, forgive me for being blunt, you're doing it wrong.
And the chances of getting caught, this is what we discussed the other day, are really increasing now. And that can come from a lot of different areas where the employee rats you out, somebody else does, you have some kind of OSHA inspection, everybody's all connected. So anyway, that's a real risk, and it can be very expensive if that happens. So bottom line, call you, discuss it, see what kind of liability they have. Is that right?
I'm happy to talk with anybody. You know, as I noted in the last session, two key, regardless of where you fall on these six factors, if you're working with people you're treating as independent contractors, I don't need to get into the details of those six factors with you to tell you, you better have a written contract, and that contract better include two key provisions. I noted this last week. One, that the individual is free to work for other companies. And number two, the individual is free to reject work. Those two provisions are not going to automatically win the day for you, but it'll help you maybe squeeze your foot in the door to potentially successfully argue that you've classified them correctly. But again, what's tripping people up, Dave, is that those individuals, and again, I tease, that nobody's doing it right. And here's the key factor that people are losing on. These individuals are not making any investment in trying to grow their business as a installer. They don't need to make the same level of investment as the employer, but they need to make the same types of investment as that employer is making how is the employer looking to grow their business? Advertising. You know, what other investments are they making in their business to try to grow and put themselves out to the public? Is the individual making those same types of investments?
Okay, well, that brings us into the topic I really want to discuss with you, and that is non-competes and what's happened with that just last week. But first, I want to give a quick shout out to our sponsor, and that is Ruby. So let's hear it from John.
Support for the Roofer Coach podcast comes from Ruby, the number one customer communication solution for growing roofing businesses. 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, Ruby creates exceptional experiences for your callers and website visitors. They take messages, screen and transfer callers, schedule appointments, perform new customer intake, confirm details with outbound calls, and much more. Just like an in-house receptionist, only better, because they turn every ring into a relationship. It all adds up to more opportunities and more time saved. For more information, visit get.ruby.com/theroofercoach for up to $150 off your first month. Imagine you powered by Ruby.
Now, coincidentally, we did an episode, this is going back to 114, and this was June of 2019. What are we on now? 380 here. I mean, it's crazy. Great. I've been doing this a long time. You've been doing it with me for a long time. But that was how to protect from employee poaching. Now, we always had non-competes because I had a bad experience where one of my sales guys grabbed a lot of insider information, took a number of customers with him, plus a couple of our key guys in the field. And that really sucked, pissed me off. So what are you going to do? I'm going to sue you. That didn't work. Trust me. So we discussed that. And from there on, we always had non-competes for our key employees. So now you're telling me that doesn't work. And you should check out episode number 114 because we really get into the details and so forth on how to do this the right way. And that was back then. However, something's changed. What's going on now?
Well, I mean, Dave, this is just crazy. The Federal Trade Commission last week, now this is a 5-member panel, voted 3-2 to basically strike down all existing non-compete agreements with a limited exception, few limited exceptions, and also made non-competes illegal across the board going forward. Now, this is a rule that the FTC, again, voted on 3-2. It becomes effective 120 days from when it is published in the Federal Register. I just checked before we went online. I didn't see it yet published, but that could happen today. In any event, I would expect, now, if the rule survives, and I don't think it will, but if it does survive, its effective date isn't going to be until sometime in August, 120 days after it's eventually published in the Federal Register. So that's what happened last week. And lawsuits were filed immediately to enjoin and stop and to argue the FTC exceeded its authority, among other arguments out there. And these lawsuits, I do think, in my professional opinion, will be successful in blocking the implementation or the effective date of the rule while the case proceeds through appeals, which could take, you know, 12, 18, 24 months. But I think at the end of the day, too, that this is not going to be an act that would be upheld as legal. So I do expect before the effective date for a court to come in and say, hey, this cannot be enforced while the case continues to its conclusion. But Dave, why, you know, this is, it really strikes me as crazy. And that's because in my seat, I still to this day, you refer to 2019, that work hasn't slowed down for me. In fact, as the labor market has gotten tighter, I'm dealing more and more with, you know, both sides of it. The company's looking to hire people bound to these agreements, and the company's looking to bind their existing workforce to these types of agreements. And, you know, here the FTC says, you know, hey, this impacts, it creates unfair competition. And they are actually saying a non-compete provision is an act, you know, that is unfair competition. And it's not just, let me first explain, when we talk about a non-compete being struck down, the way the rule is actually written, you know, the quick school of thought is, well, at least they didn't strike down non-solicitation of customers provisions, for example, yeah, or confidentiality provisions. But the way non-competition is defined in the new rule, if the argument could be made that these non-solicitation or confidentiality provisions actually keep someone from being able to procure new employment, if the argument could be made that they fit within non-competition, then those are also at risk. Now, it's non-solicitation of customers and confidentiality provisions are not expressly addressed in the new rule. The exception I speak about is only pertains to existing agreements with senior executives. And senior executive is defined in the rule. Think someone with like CEO, like policy making authority, not policy making input, but actually policy making authority. Plus, there's a salary level test as it concerns whether someone qualifies as a senior executive, and that's in excess of $151,000 income threshold. And that's, again, with existing agreements. These senior executives can't be bound to non-compete agreements after the effective date. And again, I'm suggesting that this rule won't survive. But it's put everybody into an uproar because how far-reaching it is. And it's kind of circular because it's so far-reaching, I believe, supports the argument that it's an overreach of their authority and the court will strike it down. But it has been published, and we'll see what happens here in the next few months, Dave. But right now it's got a lot of people on edge because not only does it strike down and make illegal these non-compete agreements with the senior executive exemption I just told you, but the rule would actually require employers to provide written notice to their employees if they're bound to these agreements, that the agreements are not enforceable and won't be enforced. And you have to provide that written notice in accordance with the rule. There's actually a model notice included in the rule itself. So it's you know, not only making these agreements unenforceable, but obligating employers to let their employees know, hey, you may have signed an agreement, but it's not enforceable and we can't enforce it and we won't.
Well, this is a good time to touch, revisit non-competes, why you would want to have them. And as you say, the labor market is really tight. You want to protect yourself. I certainly did. And this is particularly, I think, when it comes to salespeople, because they're the ones that have the contact with your current customers, perhaps. You can really, really get hurt if one of your guys, you know, your key guys takes off and goes into business for themselves or goes to work for another company, which is generally the case. What's a non-compete? Why should we have them as employers? And what are some key provisions that we need to have? And this is assuming that this new law or new ruling is going to get overturned, I guess. Is that right?
If I'm gambling, my money's heavily on this rule doesn't survive. But there is a lot of confusion as to what really typically is a non-compete. I have clients often asking for non-competes. Then I get into explaining the difference between a non-compete and a non-solicitation. And they say, oh, no, I just want to protect them from getting my customers. So a non-compete, your typical garden variety non-compete provision, keeps your employee, if it's going to be enforceable, and I'm using the term enforceable loosely because it's a state law issue. Every state has different rules on, you know, what it requires to have an enforceable non-compete provision. But typically, your non-compete provision says, hey, employee, you're not going to work for a competing business doing what you are doing for me for a certain period of time within a certain geographic area. The time period, typically in most jurisdictions, 2 years is considered reasonable. Anything beyond that, there's a presumption that it's unreasonable. And in terms of geographic restrictions, you know, typically, we're focusing on where the employee was providing services as opposed to where the company is doing business, you better your chances to argue that it's enforceable. But that's different than a non-solicitation. A non-solicitation of customers would still allow your worker to go to work for a competitor. They're just not going to be able to solicit your business or the business, you know, guys, the competing business in the same roofing industry. You know, they're not going to be able to solicit roofing work, for example, from those customers that they, you know, serviced while employed with your company. So, you know, there's the rub. I mean, when I have that conversation, the client typically says, well, I don't want to keep them out of the industry. I just don't want them calling on our customers. Now, so that's your non-solicitation, but that still leaves open the possibility what happens if the customer initiates the contact? Well, there wouldn't be a violation of a non-solicitation provision. A non-compete would shut that down. Typically, in my experience, after I've done explaining the difference between the two agreements with the roofing contractor clients, what I'm telling you next is based on what I'm hearing from our clients and decisions our clients are making. They're typically looking to bind an estimator or maybe a salesman to a non-compete because they're worried about their bid method being, you know, that this person carrying the knowledge of how the current company is bidding its work, and they don't want to lose opportunity for new work with an employee knowing how to underbid, you know, the company they're coming from. And that's really where I have roofing contractors seeking a non-compete. Outside of the estimator, you know, we're really just strictly dealing with a non-solicitation of customers, although clients are also asking for non-solicitation of employees. But most of our clients fall back and say, I'm not intending to keep them out of the industry. I just want the non-solicitation of customers provision. But again, Dave, I noted it kind of in passing a few minutes ago. The way that non-competition is defined in the FTC rule, depending on how a non-solicitation provision is drafted and implemented, someone looking to get out from that clause has room to argue that that is a non-compete provision under the definition in the FTC rule. But again, that all assumes the FTC rule is going to survive. And, you know, David, we're recording this. It's going to stay up on your website. I may end up with egg on my face here, but I don't see it passing. I don't see it surviving.
Well, we'll find out. The pendulum always swings administration to administration, yeah, as we talk about. We've got Biden in there now. A lot of things have been overturned, the Trump rules and so forth. And it's just the way it is. It's been like that for a long time. Well, Philip, I really appreciate you coming on and just giving everybody a quick update on this. And as we talk all the time about on this show, there's more involved than selling roofs and installing roofs. You guys are running a business now. Whether you're selling shoes or selling roofs, you are running a business and you're a business person. You've got to be aware of all of these things, because all of these risks, these minefields that we talk about, all the time, it's crazy. And when you go through them, the experience is terrible. It just sucks the life out of you. And, you know, a few of these have slipped through. You always kept us out of trouble. I recommend everybody getting in touch with Philip and checking this stuff out, because all of these things are important. Philip, how do they get in touch with you? And let's just send them straight to your website. What is that?
Sure. My website is hpssslaw.com. That's hpssslaw.com. For my website, you can sign up for our e-blast. We put out e-blasts that touch on all these topics, and I'll be putting one soon on the new overtime salary level here in the next little bit as well.
And these guys are great. All you do is construction. You've got a lot of roofing clients, including us, and it's been great. It's always good to talk with you, Philip. And we'll wait and see what comes up next week, and we'll get you back on when it's necessary.
Dave, I appreciate it. And thank everybody for listening. And don't be a stranger. Holler at me.
All right. See you soon. All right. Well, that's it for the show today. I really appreciate everybody listening. So you guys get into the business thinking that, you know, hey, all there is to this is we've got to sell work, do work, and keep score. And that's the three legs of our stool. But within those three legs, it can get a little complicated. And this is just one example. All the legal issues you don't think about. It is complicated and it can be overwhelming. And if you're not ready to take that on, you know, you should go sell roofs for somebody else. It's, you could make a lot of money and you don't have all these headaches because it's complicated. But if you need some help on putting all this together and running a good, solid business where you're not working nights and weekends and wearing all the hats, going crazy, get in touch with me. I can talk to you about our coaching programs that can really help you out. Get out of this day-to-day grind. Just go to our website at theroofershow.com. Go to our contact page. Hit the big button. Set up an appointment with me, and we can have a half hour, 45 minute chat over the phone and find out if I can help you in your business or what's going on, and at least give you a few tips. All right. Well, we will see you next week on The Roofer Show.